You've got a limp, you've got back pain from the nerve impingement again. They got the claws in you, my friend, into your claim I'll fight again. Depose the witness from the scene, your med bills are on a lien. Fight for you, I'll so fight for you. Oh, when a car crashes into you, and I'll make them pay. We make them pay in a jury trial.
Well played.
He's like a mix in between a Fergie and Jesus. Trial.
Wow.
Who is that?
That's Greg Schaefer.
That is Greg Schaefer of the Justice Team.
That's Schaefer?
I love that.
No.
Yeah.
That's your trial partner.
Oh, wow.
Hey, girl, I think, you know.
Newfound respect.
Hey, girl, I think, you know. Where was that going?
Really, Tom?
I had to cut myself because HR is in front of me.
You're welcome, Evie.
Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this edition of the podcast of the Justice Team. And that was the Justice Team's very own Greg Schaefer with his original lyrics. If you want to hear the full, and he has a full 4-minute rendition of lyrics that he wrote himself, email your questions and your request to media@justiceteam.com. And he's starting a trial with our very own Ibieri Sect.
Woohoo! Say, start Monday. Man, Greg's got vocals.
It's no auto tune.
No.
No.
Oh, wow.
And okay. Evie, how many trial continuances did you have to shield off to get this one?
I think we're at 8 right now. We're at 8. But we've got our judge. I'm ready.
Well played. And
thank
and
you.
To her right, we have Sevi Willard Fisher.
Hello.
Right. And we have another Justice Team member, Thomas S. Fair Esquire.
Hola.
And we have a very special guest. Very special. We have the eight-figure man of the day, Mr. 3PCO. Mr. Keith Bruno of Carpenter Zuckerman Rally, and Bruno Nalo.
Can I just say that that intro song was the second best song I've heard since Philip Layfield's Poppin' Policy.
Oh, stop.
Song.
Wow. Dude,
he went there already.
Not even 5 minutes into the podcast.
Sorry. Hey, good morning, everybody.
Welcome, everybody, to this edition of the podcast, The Just Team. This one, we're talking about big damages, general damages. We're going to tell you all the tricks of the trade that we've learned here at our firm and what Keith's been doing that's very successful about how to ask for the money. Show us the money. So we'll get into a little bit of the ask in a second, but I want to start this one with talking about just some common mistakes.
Can I talk about my drink?
Oh, God.
Little brother's always getting forgotten back here.
So I forgot my little brother's on the podcast. We go to sleep. My mom made him be on this one.
My dad made me hire him.
Yeah, my dad made me hire him. He's serving a drink. Brandon, why don't you tell us what we're serving today?
It's a whiskey sour with a little bit of smoke. It's called a campfire whiskey sour. It's got it's a whiskey sour, basically, with rosemary in it. You're supposed to light the rosemary on fire and throw it in there and make it smoke, but I couldn't get it to light for some reason. The alcohol wouldn't let it ignite. I don't know what happened. I thought for sure that would do it, but it's just a whiskey sour with a little bit of rosemary in it, pretty much.
That description. It's like I'm right there.
Yeah, you are right here. You're here, man. You're living
it. How does it tie into today's general damages?
You're a little sour. You're a little sourpuss. That's
like,
it.
It's
and,
like the guy that used to write for Elaine's magazine and Seinfeld. You know, it was so poetic.
Jay Peterman.
Yeah. Thank you for the reference. All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about, because I'm going to try to go sequentially through the trial here, and I want to talk, first of all, and Keith, I'm going to ask you this question first. How do you start to bring up the concept of general damages or ask for money or the concept, starting with like mini opening or jury selection? What do you do?
I start talking about money right away. Almost always in a context that's not what the injuries are or what the non-economic damages are worth to my client. So I'll usually set the stage, talk about, I'll introduce non-economic damages as a concept that's difficult for people. It's difficult to determine whether someone else is in pain. It's difficult to determine how much that might be. We don't have the same difficulty when we're talking about material objects, even though we all say that we value the immaterial objects, our health, our happiness, much greater than material objects. So with that as a premise, I'll say, you know, can you imagine if you were in a trial and let's say you had Oprah's house and Oprah was throwing a party, and Oprah's worth about $3 billion, and Oprah's house is about a $250 million house. So right away, I'm throwing out money. I'm throwing out huge sums of money, $3 billion, $250 million. And when you walk into Oprah's house, Oprah has one of those large circular tables right in the foyer when you walk in, and it has nothing to do. It's not a table that people sit at. It's a table that rich people put. Like,
when are you going over this?
This is in Vordire.
Okay.
This is in Vordire. So I'm introducing them very quickly, kind of rapid fire, to this concept of Oprah's got this vase on this table. And let's suppose somebody negligently knocked over the vase. They were playing football or they got drunk or they did something that was really irresponsible and they knocked over the vase. And you find out that the vase is worth $25 million and they won't pay for this. They won't step up and actually pay for what they broke. So we're here in trial and now we're going to have to decide how much this vase is worth. How much is it worth? I start asking people. You know, let's suppose that I show you that the evidence says that this vase is worth $25 million. And usually you get people right away that says, well, I guess the verdict would be $25 million. Hmm. I said, well, that's true. I mean, we don't have problems, or we don't have a problem valuing a vase, an inanimate object, at something that it's worth because the market says it's worth. So what if it's someone's spine? You know, what do we value it then? So it's not so much to get them, you know, to this aha moment. It's to carry a theme throughout the trial that you'll return to, where they've already accepted the fact that they could be jurors. They could be jurors sitting on a trial of a $25 million vase. And if it's at Oprah's house, nobody has any objection to this vase being worth $25 million. So at the end, you can bring it back and say, you know, I think that, you know, Miss Rojas's spine is worth more than any vase I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a human being's spine.
So how often do you catch an objection, or you're not allowed to say the specific dollar? Because some jurisdictions, some judges, they just said, look, you're not going to say numbers.
So I haven't yet. And that's always been my workaround when they say you can't talk about the numbers that you're going to ask for. And I say, Your Honor, I'm not going to ask for $3 billion in this case. I'm not going to ask for $250 million. Right, exactly. Maybe I'll ask for $25. But really what you're doing is you're getting them comfortable with high numbers, with hearing it. You're getting comfortable with having it come out of your mouth because that's very difficult too. And when I transitioned from criminal defense to plaintiff's work, you know, 4 years ago, the first time I ever stood up in front of a jury and said $5 million, I think I said, $5 million? You know, I didn't believe it myself. It was ridiculous, you know? And I'll talk a little bit about that more later, but it's a hard thing to do, especially if the only information that you have is from other people that have told you how much they think the case is worth, as opposed to you really sitting down and saying, what's this case worth? Not what it's worth on a listserv, not what it's worth, you know, as somebody that's like, well, I had somebody that stubbed their toe walking across the street and I got them $2 million. It's like, yeah, great. Yeah. You did, I guess, you know, but in the real world, if you're going to alienate the jury by throwing out a number that is so wildly adverse, to the actual number that you have, you won't believe it. And if you don't believe it, they certainly won't believe it.
So when you're given this vase story at Oprah's house, is that the number you're going to ask for? Or is it just no. bigger or smaller? How do you gauge that?
I usually ask for a little less. So the vase tends to fluctuate in value.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
I want the spine. I want it to be an easy, you know, you got to believe that Oprah would have a $25 million vase. She probably would. You know, she probably has three of them. But then it's just a way of...
What kind of flowers, Sevi, do you think Oprah would put a $25 million vase?
I mean, they got to be worth at least $4
million. What kind of flowers worth $4 million? Like a super rare orchid? I mean, come on.
Golden fake rose? You've never heard of those?
Steven Singer.
Yeah.
I actually was thinking orchids.
Yeah, I was thinking orchids too. Gold plated.
Gold plated.
What about the people that just, you know, we wouldn't really make somebody pay for that. I mean, it's Oprah. She could just buy another one, right? I mean, you're going to make some poor person pay $25 million for a vase? I mean, what if they can't afford it?
Yeah, doesn't Oprah have insurance for this, Mr. Bruno? Like, why are we here?
Well, what? You're going to punish that poor defendant who doesn't have any money?
It's funny, what you guys are saying
is exactly how voir dire should go. And that's why you shouldn't necessarily go in there with this idea that I'm going to do this question and then this question and then this question, or I'm going to do this area I'm going to cover and then this area, because let the jurors take you where you need to go, because those are the questions that you get into insurance, you get into sympathy, you get into not considering the wealth of these folks. So all of what you're doing is raising the questions that need to be answered.
I mean, these scripts, there could be some helpful, but go off script, right? Don't be using
scripts. I would say scripts are, okay, the idea is be prepared, right? So just like you do the box of death, for example, do you use everything in there?
Oh, no.
You'd be crazy to do that. So you, as a trial lawyer, we're here managing chaos. We're managing uncertainty. We're managing countless variables that we don't know how they're going to play out. And that's why we have to be so prepared for any situation. And you may use 5% of that, but you know what? If you were prepared for it, you're ready to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Ebi, yes. You have a trial coming up on next week, and I know you haven't met your trial judge yet, but what are your thoughts on doing a mini opening and jury selection and the money aspect of the case? Have you given it thought so
yes,
far?
Yes, I have. I love the idea of a mini opening. I saw it done really effectively in a lot of people's cases. I just think it's a really good opportunity to introduce the client to the jury. You can do it in a lot of different ways. You can talk about their background, tell them their grandparent, grandmother, you know, just really important facts so that you can kind of color who they are before you actually get to the opening statement. I don't typically talk about money in the mini opening, but I do jump right into it in voir dire. I agree with Keith. It's sometimes a challenge with just a specific number, but the way I approach it is you just head on. Money for pain and suffering.
So do you generally come up with, this is what I'm going to ask in closing before the trial starts?
Yes. And I say, it might be, we will be asking in the millions of dollars.
I usually have a range too in my mind. And based on the defense conduct almost always during the trial, that's when that range either gets pushed to the top, or if bad things come out, I know that I'll do my client a disservice if I try to push the envelope.
Absolutely.
So I try to either give a range or leave it somewhat deliberately vague, as you're saying.
Yes. I found that if you don't do that, they're offended when they hear it for the first time. Yeah. They're like, whoa.
Absolutely.
And they feel betrayed. Like, right. How dare you pull the wool over my eyes? You had me sitting here this whole time thinking this was a $25,000 case.
I thought you cared, in the area.
Right. You know, and they start to, you can feel it. But when you put it out there early, they're with you. And then you can get a sense, oh, that person needs a little bit more information before they get to the millions. But you have to introduce it. I think it's a failure if you don't.
Yeah. So, Sevi, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think, you know, when you're talking about a lot of money, regardless of when you say it or how much you say, I think you just got to believe it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'm a big, you know, I feel like if I say something to you that's bullshit, I think you can see that all over my face for the most part. And I feel like a jury can read you better than you think. And I just feel like whatever you say, whatever number you give, you know, whether it's a range, whether it's millions, you just got to believe it. And that's something that starts, I think, long before the trial. It starts with talking to your client. It starts with understanding their injuries. And I think if, you know, regardless of what number you say, I think if you believe it, I think the jury can believe it too.
I do. I 100% agree with that. I also love the early point. I was in San Diego on a brain injury case with Teresa Bowen. And we're picking a jury, and I kept saying $20 million, $20 million. I'm going to ask for $20 million in that range. I kept saying in that range. So I had, to Tom's point, where you can't ever script this stuff, I had a juror that was giving, you know, he was the talkative one. He wanted to be the contrarian, the one, you know, that everybody looks at. And he said, I have a problem with $20 million. So I said, well, you know, tell me about that, sir. And he's like, $10 million, fine.
but 20 million, I mean, that's way too much. And I'm like, you'll be just fine, sir.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
Right. We can work with you, sir.
But do you find, I mean, I think the consensus is the same. That jury should not be hearing a large number at the close of your case, right?
For the first time.
Yeah, definitely not.
Because think about it. We deal with these numbers that are astronomical because we also know how the pie gets split up later on, and we know how the jurors make decisions. They rarely give the full ask. So to a regular person...
You don't get the full ask?
Sometimes. Ooh. To the regular person, they usually send a note, you know, seeing if they can give more than what Mr.
That
Bowman suggested.
That was you. You were the guy.
That's right.
That happens.
He's the guy.
Saw it on TV. Must happen. If you introduce the concept that late in the game, you're talking to people who will never see, they don't expect to see $5 million in their lifetime. $1 million. I mean, I know I sound like Dr. Evil, but $1 million is a ton of money. It's a huge sum of money. And we shouldn't forget that as trial lawyers, that this is what, that is a large sum of money to teachers, to engineers, to lawyers, to normal folk.
Yeah. So Tom Fair is getting a refill. Tom, what do you have now?
What's going on? Looks like that 4-day sobriety is out the window.
Yeah.
He made it far with the Lent. So
I've got to balance out my poison.
Friday. He's talking about what he hasn't done since Sunday.
Yeah. My body's just craving some alcohol now.
Jeez. Yeah, that's terrible.
It's terrible. Who's got the shakes here?
Not me.
So I want to take a step. So how do you start working up those general damages prior to actually getting to trial? And by that, I mean, what exhibits do you find useful, or what things do you do even during expert discovery to help build your damages story, to help for that general damage, that pain and suffering ask? EB, what are some things that you find effective?
Well, I think at the core of every good trial is a good story. And if you can find if you can show the drastic change in someone's lifestyle, you know, the before and after photos, the life that they lived before this injury. And then you can show, I find it really effective to show x-rays. People they cringe when they see pins and bones, and they're thinking, wow, if that were me, that'd be crazy. So all the visuals of the impact of the injury in the person's life, I think, is really, really important. And then if you can tell the story and they feel compassionate about your client, that's when someone like Keith Rule can get up and say, I want $20 million. And people raise their hand and says, I can give them 10, you know, because they feel it. They feel it.
How about you, Sam?
Yeah. What was the question again?
I want
to. Sorry, that was.
What is he drinking?
How do you go about it?
He said two refills. No, so. Seb,
telling the story. Okay. I remember.
But I have a different, because I've seen you do it effectively when you're taking expert depositions. Like, how are you building defense expert depositions? How are you building your damages stories through them?
So, what I do is, and I think something that everyone can sort of relate to is pain. I think everybody, even somebody who has never had an injury per se, can understand pain. And so I try to take, whether it's an expert depo or just, you know, redirecting my own, I do it. I redirect my own expert in my own client's depositions just to ask maybe two or three questions that I want to make sure they're not Kennemerd on. And these questions always are, especially if they've had a fusion, listen, doctor, can you state to a reasonable degree of medical probability, you would agree, that my client will be in some degree of pain for the rest of their life? 9 times out of 10, I get a yes. Even with the defense doctors. Doctor, also, would you agree to a reasonable degree of medical probability, my client for the rest of their life will have limited function in their neck or back because of this surgery for the rest of their life? Yes. And if you get a lot of these yeses and you can keep going with activities that they can no longer do, or maybe take something from what your client said to that doctor in a defense medical examination, like, doc, I can't do this with so-and-so anymore. I can't surf anymore because of this fusion or whatever. Doctor, you would not recommend my client surf their passion for the rest of their life. Yes. Those are extremely powerful, especially coming from
the opposing side's experts who's getting up there telling your, you know, the defense, you know, lawyer getting up there telling to award your client $5,000 when their own hired gun says your client cannot do their passion for the rest of his life or her life.
And I think
life.
That's powerful. It's one thing to talk in the abstract. People have pain and they have suffering, but you have to use specific examples of how it affects their life.
Right.
And how it affects their timeline over life. So, Tom, how do you explain to the jurors the longevity of this sustaining injury, whether it's like a fusion or if it's some sort of catastrophic or CRPS? Like, how do you describe that over the milestones of their life to make it real for the jurors?
One day this person is going to be 60 years old, maybe 70, and they're going to be sitting in a wheelchair. And, you know, Josie or Kevin or whoever the name is of the caretaker that's coming by to change their diapers or to turn them over on their bed, whatever the situation is going to be doing that. And my client, I won't say client, but depending on who their name is, you know, Jenny or whoever it is, you know, she's going to be sitting there.
Keith
is going to be sitting there in his bed and he's going to be thinking to himself, I'm really glad that that jury gave me, you know, the money to dignify what I was going through or, you know, give me the money to have the resources to take care of myself. Because if they didn't do it, if they shortchanged me then or if they didn't give me, you know, all the medical treatment that I need, I wouldn't have this right now. I wouldn't have this person to come to my house and to help me. I'd be all alone because I didn't have a family. Whatever it is, you tell the story. In a way, you tell the story of the person at that age, okay? So you go there and you bring the jury and you say, I want you to walk into this person's room and what it's like 40 years from now, because whatever you give them right now has to be good 40 years from now. When Keith is looking back 40 years from this verdict, he's got to be able to say, and you all have to be able to say that we gave him sufficient, money or whatever it is, we gave him what he needed. And it wasn't anything less and it wasn't anything more. And it's got to be good now, 20 years, 30 years, and 40 years from now. And so I try to paint a picture as to what this person's going to, what their life is going to be like without this. And there's an element, you know, people talk about reptile or whatever, but really it's just imagine being someone who doesn't have the resources to just do your basic daily living functions. And that's what we're talking about here. And I think you need to paint that picture. You know, that's how I do it.
Yeah. Keith, do you
Can I just jump on that for a second? Because
yeah. We
talk...
The
substance...
No, forbidden.
No.
Just kidding, go.
The substance...
Wait, forbidden. Okay, go.
Thank you. The substance of what Tom said was incredibly important. What else was really important was his delivery. When you're giving that message, and I've seen Tom in trial, and I know he can go crazy and yell and scream and turn bright red and maybe even throw stuff. But when you're giving that message where you want them to come 20, 30 years from now, that is the calm voice and the crystal clear delivery that you need. It's not, and that's why lists don't work. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to be in the moment, because if you want these people to actually come with you on a 60-day or 60-year journey, you have to do it like that. That's not the time to go, imagine Keith in 60 years! 60 years! No.
And what does that do? So I did that on purpose. You know, when you ask that question, I had to take a moment, take mm-hmm. a breath, because my default is to be aggressive. My default is to be a fast talker. I love being around people. It's like what gets my energy going. But the minute I slowed down what I was saying, everybody changed their demeanor. I mean, even Bob had to look at me, you know, he's like actually tuning in for a second. But I'm just saying that you're absolutely right. And sometimes it doesn't even matter so much what you're saying, because the jury gets how important it is to what you're doing. And it matters.
And I think you really have to honestly believe it in your heart. You have to see it and believe it for, because the jury can tell if you're being genuine or if you're just selling fool's gold. And I've seen Tom do that. He believes it. He sits on counsel table and he looks at the jury. He looks at his client and he just describes exactly what they've gone through and what they're going to go through for the rest of their life.
I like to add that you also have to know your client well enough to be able to fast forward 20 years to think about what it is that they're going to be experiencing or what they'll be missing out on.
So one of, we jumped in this topic, and the way that I saw this when I was thinking about this topic is it really boils down to three things, three fundamental things, and we've hit on two of them and we haven't hit on the other. But number one, and most importantly, you have to know what the value of your client's injuries are. Okay, and that means you have to take a deep look into your heart and yourself. You need to spend time with your client. The other thing is you need to actually talk about this idea of what the damages are, right? So this is where you're discussing all of the things that your client's going through. But then there's a counter, just like with a battery, you got a plus and minus sign. It's the betrayal by the defense. And what drives up general damages is the betrayal of the defense. Because if you sit there and just talk about how bad this is for your client or what they've had to overcome, you're only talking about half the story or even less, really. And if you put it in the context of betrayal by the defense, or some people use terms like reptile, I don't really subscribe to that term. I don't think it's adequate. I don't think it describes what we're trying to do. But it's really the betrayal by the defense. And it's kind of a good and evil, and you have to have both those balances, and then you have to know what the value is. And if you use all three of those things, that's the beginning of a big general damages verdict.
Tom, I got to ask you, what kind of shirt is that? It's very nice.
I broke this out from 2013. Seriously, my wife was making fun of me today because none of my shirts fit anymore. They all look like blouses. So I had to go back into the closet deep, deep, deep to grab this one.
Yeah, no one could tell.
And Keith, that leads me to one of the viewer questions. We ask before at media@justiceteam.com, ask any questions. And knowing you were going to be in the podcast, we actually got a serious question. And they ask, how many three-piece suits does Keith Bruno own?
I own? I'm wearing one now. I own at minimum 12.
Because nice.
Yes.
No?
What?
Damn, that's a lot of three-piecers.
Well, I don't buy suits that don't also have a vest. So I need... Look.
Don't you get hot? I mean, honest question. Don't you like get like a little...
Yeah, I'm pretty hot.
I feel like sometimes I wear a vest, it like makes my... my belly a little too obvious?
Well, my belly is obvious. So, I'm 43 and married happily, so I don't care.
You just feel like you're obvious.
I feel like Philip Drummond in Different Strokes, you know? Like, I'm
a three-piece suit. Save me.
Oh, Philly.
I won't lie. I like the taking off the coat during trial. Like, I don't do it personally. But I see the...
You did in that case on Palm Springs.
We all know
120
why.
120 degrees.
I was literally... I started sweating
Matt
profusely. It was 100 degrees by like 7:30 a.m. and the AC wasn't working in Palm Springs courthouse. And I started sweating so bad during voir dire. I'm like grabbing tissue. The judge is handing me tissue.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm grabbing the tissue. You know, pieces are getting stuck to my face. And I'm like totally making fun of myself. I'm making fun of myself to the jury. I'm like, look at me. I must be so scared and so nervous. And I was, you know what I mean? This is back in the day. I still am every now and then, but it was hilarious. It was a good time.
So let's take a little bit of a turn here. And I want to ask a different topic. I'll start with you, EB.
Sure.
Are there any horror stories you have about a plaintiff, a client of yours that took the stand and just, whether on direct or on cross, just killed your general damages theme and your vibe, and you just knew it.
Yeah,
Jacob, I mean,
all about that.
Yeah,
taco.
It happens, and yes, I did have a client, and I think what the issue was, this client was not willing, I think, to take personal responsibility for her role in what occurred. And I take responsibility for that too, because I didn't properly prep her for that. I think I could have done more. And really it was just about being open and honest with the jury about, look, I'm injured, and I know that there are things that I could have done differently, rather than, you know what, I'm here because that person did XYZ and my life is miserable and I'm upset. People totally were turned off. And I saw it unfolding on the stand, and I could just see the jury cringing. Like, all they really wanted her to say was, like, you know, I feel bad about what happened. I could have done things a little bit differently. And that's it. And that's something that I take into every case. Anytime I talk to the client, I'm wondering, you know, how do you feel about what happened? What could you have done differently? And are you going to be big enough to own that on the stand if it comes
And I think a lot of the times the jurors want to hear that this is somebody they want to help, somebody that if they give compensation to is going to better themselves or use it for betterment. So they need to hear a story that here's what I'm doing to get better, but I need help, and this sucks. This is my life. It sucks. But I need help. I'm going to get through it. I'm going to do it. Every time that's the mantra and that's the story, I think that leads to the largest verdicts that I've had, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because that has to be the mantra. Nobody wants up there to say, oh, woe is me.
There's a way to do that, too, actually, that's fascinating. And it's a real subtle change in what you say. And imagine if you say, look, I can't walk anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't run a mile. But imagine if you said instead of that, you said, you know, about a year after this crash, that was about the first time I was able to walk around the block. And it really made me feel good because I hadn't been able to do that. And I kept working on it. And now I can actually walk two blocks. Now I can do that. I can actually do two circles around my entire block. Or, you know, instead of saying, I've never had a good night's rest, be like, 2 years after this crash, once I had, you know, the surgery, that was the first time I had a good night's sleep. Mm-hmm. I slept 8 hours, first time. And everyone knows what that means, but you didn't frame it in the negative. You framed it in the positive. And I think it's important because everyone, you know, people that are truly hurt, I know me, when if I get sick or if I'm hurt, I'm upset about it. You know, I want to keep doing my day. And so the minute I have an opportunity that I'm feeling good, I'm out there doing what I need to do, you know? And so we want to see people that are doing that. We don't want to see whiners, right? Nobody likes to vote for a whiner.
And I think a really good way to do it, I started doing this a few years ago, is, you know, just ask the client when they get on the stand, how are you doing today? And you want them to say, today's a good day.
Yeah.
Today's a good day.
I've been looking forward to today.
Right. And actually I feel better today than I did a couple of years ago. Or today was easier than it was yesterday. Yeah. Something like that. People like that optimism.
And, you know, and it feels good because I've waited 2 years to tell my story. You know, I'm just thankful. Like Tom's.
I'm laughing because I'm like, you know, they come out with Sabrosa or they got pictures of my guy working out.
You have to catch that thing.
I'm like, of course he's working out. The doctor told him to work out. I'm like, yeah, he worked out. He lost weight. He's got a brain injury and he learned how to fly a plane and all this stuff. I'm like, that's because he's striving.
He learned how to fly a plane.
I had that case. I'm in Orange County with a guy that, you know, I mean, he learned how to fly a freaking plane with a brain injury.
That's technical skills, though. Technical.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's not
the right part of the brain that was affected.
That's called neuroplasticity, my friends. Neuroplasticity. You can Google that.
It was actually just the emotional part that was injured, which is better when you're flying anyway.
Let me segue and pivot into this. Let's talk a little bit about when they got video of your client. And you sniffed it out. You've seen it before, and you could tell by the questions they're asking. They got video of your guy or gal. So how do we handle that? And Tom, I mean, you had your last trial or two trials, whatever.
Yeah.
Last month, whatever.
Whatever
it was.
Yeah.
I mean, you dealt with that. You saw it coming, then you got the footage before your guy took the stand. I mean, and you dealt with it great. Tell us how you did that.
I'm telling you, I thought this was going to hurt me. You know, at first you get scared. This is normal, you know, this idea of fear. And if you can't be open with yourself about your fear or like that you're scared, you already got one foot in the grave because you have to acknowledge that. The reason you're scared is because you think the jury's going to buy into it, right? So defense attorney got really cocky about it and showed me the Sabrosa. And my guy said, you know, he couldn't work, but he's doing construction before his fusion surgery. But I there was voluminous records, thousands of pages, and I remember there was one record that one doctor told him to go back to work, told him he could lift 20 pounds, told him he could walk for 6 hours straight, told him he could bend and twist for 4 hours. So the Dr. defense attorney. No, it was a work comp doc, but the defense was so bullish on this, and they put up Mary Jesko as a life care planner in Evoke Rehab. And basically with her, I was like, you must work hand in hand with doctors. Yes. And you know, you're not a doctor yourself, so you listen to what their recommendations are. Yes. And the clients, you know, the patient listens to what their recommendations are. Yes. And I'm like, so for this client, if he was walking around with 20 pounds doing flies, I don't know, curls with 20 pound dumbbells, he'd actually be in compliance with the doctor. Yes. And in fact, if he wanted to sit here for 6 hours straight and not even get up once, he would be in compliance with what the doctor said. And if by chance he was carrying a 2x4, which is 13 pounds, over his shoulder, he would be in compliance. Yes, if he was carrying a pick axe that's 5 pounds, he'd be in compliance. And I went over every single element of the Sabrosa with her, and I was staring at the defense lawyer, and he was just had his head down. I was laughing at him as I was doing this, because now I had just undermined his entire Sabrosa, and he showed it after. He had the courage to, I guess, to show it after.
I think you called him a coward in your clothes.
I did, right. I did, because he, but it worked out well.
Because Tom's courageous.
Behind the bushes with a camera?
We still, yes. You know.
Oh, okay.
No, he didn't have the courage to tell him that Tom's client was a liar, a cheat, and a fraud. He didn't have the courage to say it. He had to hide behind videos and yeah, so.
But the point is that you can take what's in the film and you can find something, I'm sure, where it justifies it. I mean, if you they got, you know, they try to bring out Facebook photos of your guy exercising or whatever. Who cares? If you have a spine injury, you're supposed to stay active. Don't give me this. What am I supposed to? You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you sit home, eat bonbons, you're lazy and right. You don't care. If you're out there and you're trying to live your life, you're clearly not injured. I'm tired of this damned if you do, damned if you don't, and I'm not going to fall into the defense's trap about that. I'm doing what I'm doing, and I care about my client. And just like I would, I'm like, heck, if you saw the stuff I did, you wouldn't know I have a herniated disc in my back. You wouldn't know that I get radiculopathy.
Objection.
Yeah, but you wouldn't know that.
Overruled.
Improper argument.
Saying, overruled.
Among us people, you know, and I try to stay as active as possible. So don't give me that baloney.
So let me give you a quick pro tip for our listeners. When there's video, you suspect there may be video of your client, put up a few damages witnesses first, because the other side cannot help but ask questions that they have video on. And I've stuffed it out so many times. Like, well, can your brother climb a ladder? ding, ding, ding. You know?
What did I do?
Playing volleyball? Yeah,
exactly.
Have you ever been to the beach?
My client takes a stand. Of course I've been to the beach. I do what I can. Of course I've been on a ladder. I'm trying to work. And then the judge is like, you're not playing video. He just said he could do those things. The defense lawyer's like, well, how'd you know I had video? Because you asked the questions to his sister.
Remember, there's one defense attorney. We knew the investigator he used, and he wouldn't disclose he had Sabrosa, so I just randomly subpoenaed the investigator company. They called back and responded, and were like, yeah, we do have video.
Of the wrong guy, as it turned out. So Keith, tell us some of your secrets of success when you're doing closing arguments. I want to know how you do the ask for the large sums of money. Some lawyers use the jury instructions and break it down per category. Some people give lump sums. I want to know, what have you found effective and how do you do it?
Okay, because I'm dealing with trying to unwind some of the consequences of this in a new trial motion right now. So
you don't have to answer. You can plead the fifth.
No. It's all proper. But when it comes down to a transcript, so 50% of your presentation is what you say. It's going to be your oratory, right? But if you're in 2019 and you're delivering a closing argument and you're not using multimedia, you're not using PowerPoint, and you're not using your body and your body language as a living 25% of the whole thing, then you're not doing it right. So what I will often do in the ask, what I used to do was I would flash the number, or I would flash the years, or I would show you what a thing of milk cost, you know, a long time ago or something like that. And sometimes I'll still incorporate that stuff. I never do the same thing all the time. But what you really want to do is you want to get the jurors to think. You don't want to say that they should, what they would accept for an injury, but you certainly want them to get, you want them to think about what it would mean to them. And the way you get them to think about what it would mean to them is to pose the question directly to the client. And whether that's putting a pre-injury photo of the client up on an 80-inch screen, and talking about damages and talking about what it's worth, and then turning to the screen and saying, what's your spine worth? What's your knee worth? What's your brain worth? What would that man say?
I think I have the same opposition to your nature of emotion.
And that's because you're making, and you have to, you're being specific about
right.
what your client's been through. Because how else?
On the transcript, it looks like you just asked the jury.
Because you said.
So, yeah.
I had the same issue.
And that's so silly because you're talking to your client. And
right.
You said, you're talking specifically about what they've been through, and you're using the word you, but you're talking to them.
Your Honor, look how many times he said you, 23 times in closing argument.
Are you asking them to give you a response? Does the client say, my brain is worth?
No, okay. Client doesn't say anything. Client sits there like a potted plant.
Got it.
And you're using silence, and you're using your body language, and what you're doing is, and this is where silence is critical, because in the silence, they're not thinking of what his spine is worth. They're thinking of what their spine is worth. And there's nothing improper about that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that says you can't do that. And in fact, what you're doing is your argument is focused on exactly what they should value, which is what this person's injury is worth. And yet you're getting them to contemplate it in a deeper way than they ever would. And because we can't come out and say, juror number four, what's your spine worth, man? $200,000? $250,000? Hell no. Like I know what my spine's worth. I know what being pain-free is worth. It's worth no amount of money that I would accept to live without pain.
Well, and be ready for the objection, too. Just talking about, I had this same exact situation in a big case Tom and I tried in Orange County. I got objected to, I think the objection was golden rule / reptile. And so I just,
reptile. Yeah.
So I collected myself just for a second, and I just started back up, and I changed you to he, and I just continued my story. I said, he's going to go through this. He's going to go through that. He's going to go through this. Do you think he would, and then I switched it back to you at some point, but
pay attention to objections.
Yeah.
You still need to go back in a more creative way to what you want to do.
Exactly.
Do you ever with the jury though, do you ever like look at them when they say, there's not enough money, or they're like, I don't want to put a dollar value on something. The idea is that there's so much value in non-economic damages, or there's so much value in a quality of life, that to put a dollar value would actually cheapen it. And I have this conversation with juries and try to tease it out, even that millions of dollars for me not being able to hold my child, or millions of dollars to not being able to make love to my wife, or whatever it is, that to put a dollar value on it, it's so incredibly valuable that you are actually cheapening it by putting 10 million or 100 million. That's how valuable it is.
I challenge them because I think it's easy. The easiest thing in the world is to do injustice. The easiest thing in the world is to value this too low. The most difficult thing for you, the jurors, to do is to value it fully. And if you think about it, it is, right? Everybody can undervalue it, and they can, go on to coffee and kids and barbecues and ball games and all that other stuff and not think about the person that they devalued until the next time they walk down to the mailbox and they open that letter and they see that jury summons inside, because that's the next time they're going to think of my client. And that's when they're really reflectively mm-hmm. going to think about whether they did full justice or whether they kind of failed. And kind of failed isn't good enough.
So EB talked about a few exhibits that are good for general damages. We talked about x-rays, CT scans, before and after photos. Are there anything else that we're using now to help tell the story, to talk about general damages? And it could be a slide or an image that we use in PowerPoints, or to help elicit a story to be able to tell the jury. So what are we using now? Like EB, what are some things that you're doing
Anything
now?
Physical. If your client is in a back brace, bring in the back brace. I think someone recently had a trial where they had a... what was it? The contraption, the
spinal cord stimulator.
Exactly. Yeah. Bring that physically into the courtroom. The things that are intrusive or invasive or limiting, when people see it, even a walker. One of the reasons people get worked up about seeing people in a wheelchair is because they're in the courtroom in a wheelchair, So a lot of our clients aren't paraplegics, but there are things in their lives that are limiting their livelihood. If you can physically bring that in, bring it in.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer. I know we all here are this. See your client, meet them on their home court. See what it's like in their life, at their homes. And I think that's where you're able to tell their story effectively, because you've been there. You've seen it. And one image that I'll never forget in a big verdict that I had, I just went client's home, met him, and I went to use the restroom, and I just opened up the medicine cabinet.
Sure, you did. Just
everyone does that.
Goodness.
Just happened to take a look, see.
I was looking for
that's
some,
what we do in the bathrooms.
That's why you haven't got the invite to my house.
Yeah.
Look, I was hoping he had some penicillin.
So anyway, I opened
what'd
it up.
What'd you find?
I did not find penicillin, but what
he
I did find.
He used to have Oxy in there.
That's Robert at justiceteam.com, ladies and gentlemen.
Winning.
But what he did have is he had a whole medicine cabinet full of medication.
Yeah.
And it was stuff he never took. And I snapped the two photos because I took two photos. It was the most powerful exhibit that I had in that trial because it made a riff with jurors. For me, I don't think jurors want to see your client unhappy in photos. They want to see imagery.
Consequences.
Yeah. Yes, consequences of it. So if you take a photo of that, or like we had one where it was just a thing she's not doing anywhere, a picture of her dog she used to play with, her cowboy boots because she used to ride her horse. Them just two by themselves. She wasn't using it. I think it's that imagery that's very powerful for the jury so that they can use it. Because if you see somebody with another person in it, I think it's a little too distant now. I mean, this is just me talking. I don't know if it's true or not. But
I like this idea.
Imagery.
I actually love this idea of yours, Bob, because it takes sort of it shows more of a quality of life and less of like just a person. And it shows something active. And I think even like in today's marketing age, right? Like you want to show something active. You don't want to just show a bunch of people like sitting there or smiling or not smiling. The boots and you know, just sitting there, they're clean, right? The cowboy boots are clean, which means this person hasn't been out there, you know, on the ranch or whatever it is. So that imagery is powerful, I think.
That also allows you to tell a story.
Yeah. The photo of an object versus an individual allows you to tell the story of that object as it relates to the client, and I think that is powerful. I did see that. I like the idea of the boots and the.
I think it's also a perspective issue. It's the golden rule hack. Because the jurors are looking at that and they could imagine themselves staring at that medicine cabinet. If they're just staring at your client whom they don't know and they don't really care about in real life, they're not walking a mile in that man's moccasins. But every one of us, some more than others, have opened up a medicine cabinet and you're thinking, damn, would I want this to be mine?
Mm-hmm. Be like, well, that's a lot of meds that guy's taking.
Keith, you owe me 10% of your next verdict because you're going to use that.
You should see the medicine cabinet. I'm going to pull it.
So, Sevi,
he's bringing some medicine of his own.
Sevi, I have a question for you. Let's talk about people to help tell your client's story. And I know you had the incomplete quadriplegic trial that you got a large verdict on in Orange County. How are you able to tell his story through other people, not experts, but other people in his life? Who do you think does a good job, and how do you prepare them?
So who do I think does a good job? I would say it depends. You got to meet them. You got to go into these people's homes. I went and met with this gentleman. What was hard for me and Tom to tell is, it was difficult to go and ask for, $20 or $30 million for somebody who was labeled an incomplete quadriplegic but was making more money after the incident than before the incident. He was walking. He was driving a car. He got a sweet young girlfriend who he's now engaged to after the incident. The most amazing things have happened to him better than ever before after the incident. So I thought to myself, gosh, this is going to be difficult because we got to go, he looks perfectly fine. So we had to go, I went to his house and just met with, I talked to his mom, his dad, and I talked to him, and they were all kind of stoic. Yeah, I don't know. I was fumbling there.
To have another one.
And then I was talking, and then I met his, I said, well, can I come meet with your girlfriend sometime? And he said, yeah, and here's her number. And so I arranged a meeting with her, now fiance, and I met with her, and she was just the sweetest, most, amazing, wonderful human being that I've personally ever met in my life. And I just fell in love with her as a person. And I said, you know what? I think I told all you guys long before we even had this trial even went, she's our star. Then trial comes around. We have some witnesses go. Then she goes. I'm doing her direct. And she starts talking about the future and these sort of landmarks in our lives and thinking about having kids with him and his inability to change a diaper or, you know, the fact that he, you know, they had a story where she, some friends came over with a little baby, and she had the little baby of the friends, and she said, "Here, you know, hold the baby to our client." And he just looked at her and he said, "No, I'm."
Man, this guy's getting me all emotional.
You know, he couldn't do it, and
he
so
didn't want to drop the baby.
Exactly. Drop the baby. And so after that trial came, we got a great verdict on a very difficult liability. We got 75%, like $15 million verdict, when we could have easily gotten 75% against our client or been defensed on liability. And the defense attorney to this day says, that fiance.
But you know what? That, you know, we did more than that, you and I. Like, we set traps. Like, these guys, you know, they had... So our guy, we're claiming that his left hand is a claw, meaning he doesn't... Because he had a spinal cord injury. And we reframed it, too, because when you say incomplete quadriplegic, everyone wants to see someone that can't move their arms and legs. Mm-hmm. Our guy's functioning. It's just the tips of his fingers and his feet don't work because... He had a spinal cord injury, so he doesn't have strength anymore. So his left hand's a claw. He's holding a selfie stick in his left hand, okay? And they're out in the middle of the snow where he's proposing to her. And you know, it's a beautiful scene. There's another scene where they're like canoeing or kayaking together, right? So, you know, they kept going. Well, here you are kayaking. Here you are doing this. So we just said, tell us about that. We'd go on redirect. Tell us about that. Well, you know, he started walking. It took him about a half hour to get there, but then he had an accident 15 minutes into it, and we couldn't get to the bathroom quick enough, and I had to wipe him right there in front of his friends and in front of his family before the engagement photo. And everyone just, like, mouth drop, right? And it's just, like, the saddest thing ever.
Yeah.
And we laid traps like that everywhere because these guys were a-holes, and honestly.
You talk about the Sabrosa. They had a Facebook thing, and you know, one of the things they got out of him is, you know, oh, it's really difficult to put gloves on. I can't put gloves on and stuff in the winter and mittens I can't put gloves on in the winter. And they have a Facebook photo of him wearing mittens. And he goes, the defense attorney goes, well, it looks like you're wearing gloves there. And she goes, no, those are mittens. He couldn't get his fingers into gloves.
But to you people know, just, that are listening, though, none of that comes... in the trial. It comes because of the preparation prior to trial. Like, there is no, it sounds trite, but there's no shortcut to the hard work. Mm-hmm. In the Godoy trial that I tried, I had this wonderful kid, 7 years old, lives in South Central, black, lost his dad. You would think, I don't have much in common with him, right? It was in doing the work that we found one of the most profound things that he encountered was he quit basketball after one practice. Okay, so why did he quit basketball? What happened? Well, it doesn't matter why he quit basketball. The reason he was allowed to quit basketball is because mom, who was doing as much as she could possibly do for this kid, wasn't dad. And dad, who was dead, would not have allowed him to quit after one game. He would have played the whole season, and then maybe he could have quit. But that lack of guidance, that came on like hour 20 of like just kicking around ideas and trying to find out, you know, focusing on something over here to the left and then out of there to the right. And it resonates with me because I'm dad and I've been divorced and I have kids that have, you know, rules that are different with mom and some rules that are different with dad. And you're like, God damn, I know what that feeling is. And now I can go and communicate that, and I can communicate that loss, that if his father was still there, that wouldn't have been something that he experienced. And then look, that's a pebble in a pond. You know, look at that life lesson that would go throughout. But you have to do the hard work of discovery. If you wait until trial, if you wait before trial, you'll never discover it.
And one thing that you're able to do, I think, you know, the preparation is key, but one thing that preparation leads to is your ability to personalize with whatever client that you have. And I think your ability to personalize, it goes back to somebody told me in law school, you want to fight for your client, you want to be a good lawyer for your client, you got to be able to personalize this to yourself. And the ability to do that makes you such a great lawyer and such a great advocate for anybody you're fighting for, because if you believe it and you feel it, you're damn straight that the jury's going to feel it.
You have to.
That was the first, that, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, you got the good and the bad and then yourself. And I actually remember we were at Brandon's house.
That's right.
And I don't know whose birthday it was, or we did the little clue thing. But this was before you did the work, Keith. And you came up to me and you said, I don't know what the damages are yet. And we were talking about it. And you were very honest with me, as I am with you, about our fears and going forward, because we know we have clients' lives at stake. And then you did the work and amazing things happened. And the same thing with Sevi and I and that $15 million verdict. I took this kid and his family and his friends to the park. And all I did was I had them roll reverse and I had them tell me stories about being in Hawaii, or tell me stories about your friends, be your friends, tell me what they would say about you before this. And I try to create, it was like I had layer after layer after layer to work with. And eventually you start to see all these things in yourself and they become a part of you and you live and breathe this person's life. And that's how it becomes real. And that's the jury knows you're not making this up anymore.
And I'm going to pivot to E, because we tried a case in UI and Tom and Van Nuys on a sexual abuse case. And we had a young African-American girl in Compton, forgotten by the system.
Yeah.
And I just want you to tell our audience what it was like with you, with your journey with her, because you spent a lot of time with her and the places you had to go with her, the things you had to do to be able to. And it was the most powerful direct examination that I've ever seen. So how did you get to that place?
Well, the first thing was just, you know, you have to, your clients have to trust you, first of all. And that comes with... spending time with them, going to their home. But, you know, with her, when I first met her, she was incarcerated. And I literally just showed up and I just asked her, you know, what books do you read here? And we just started talking about books and authors and we exchanged information. And when she was finally out of jail, you know, I would say, let's just meet up. Let's go get something to eat. What I was finding out was that she was homeless. She was living in her car. She was sleeping with men, doing all kinds of things that just offended me. But I understood that that's just where she was in her life. And one of the things that I have challenged myself in this practice, in these 10 years, is I do not judge my clients. I don't care where you're coming from, what you've been through. You will not get judgment from me. And when I was open to just seeing the raw and real about her life, and I completely embraced it, she let me in. And I said, I'll go where you go.
You have to judge yourself if you can't empathize with another person.
Exactly.
There's a breakdown there. Mm-hmm. That's on you.
That's on you.
Not on them.
Yeah.
And for sure. 100%. That's a tip for all of our listeners. 100%. No matter if you have any type of success, you continue to be successful, you cannot become this elitist that is out of touch with reality.
You will lose. Like,
if you start to be rude to the person that is at the grocery store checking you out or the people that are helping you, you've lost touch with humanity. And you will never be a good traveler. In my opinion, if you don't empathize with your fellow man, you're never going to cut it. That's just something you can't teach, and you better never lose sight of that. And I've seen some people do that.
Yeah, don't be an asshole.
Yeah. Before I even went to the ranch, and I credit the ranch to some extent about, you know, the way that I see clients, but when I started at Simon Law Group, I went to every client's house. I hung out there. I listened to their stories.
Eat their food.
Their food.
I spent so much time with them because I want to hear everything. There's a reason. If you've got a client who's got felonies, or you got a client who's you're like looking at and you're like, God, I can never see how I could get this kind of money. Ask them what their story is.
Right.
Ask them why they're there, because there's a story behind that. And when you listen to that story, you'll realize and understand that if you were in that position, you may not even be that well off. You know what I mean? So that's the important part right there.
So let's try to sum it up, everybody, because we're out of time, and I want to go through. Just give us one or two words you think is the key to big damages. What do you have to do as a lawyer to get there for big damages? I'm putting you on the spot, Keith. Go.
That's quite all right. I think you have to think it through in terms of who your client is, what the injury is, and how you can communicate it. I mean, I'm parroting Tom, but I do think it's like the triangle offense. There are elements that have to be met, and you have to do them, and then it has to be right. And then you also have to have the strength sometimes to ignore these badass travelers that we all envy and that we all look up to, and we all look at their verdict on a single level fusion, and we all want $25 million. And you have to have the strength to say, nope, this is my case. I know what this is worth.
Got it. Sevi, words of wisdom.
I would say just believe in your cause, believe in your case, and personalize. Those would be my two words. I would say believe and personalize.
Eberry?
If you ask, you shall receive.
Mm. That's good. She listened to my. She did it in like.
You know
words.
What?
She did it right. So you guys are going on and on and on and on. And on. Tom, go.
You invited a blowhard.
I'd say do the work.
Yeah, see?
Yes.
The prep. So
Hashtag do work.
You know, Keith, I want to thank you for coming on. We have a special guest, Keith Bruno. You certainly have a face for radio.
I'm a groupie for Keith.
So you got him. And ladies and gentlemen, a dozen three-piece suits. You know what? God, you are a man of fashion.
Still not a snob, even with all them suits.
I know. Even with all them suits.
So salted.
Yeah, but he's still an Eagles fan at heart, so that's why it humanizes him with the rest of the world. They boo Santa Claus. Thank you for listening. Special guest Keith Bruno, thank you. Justice team members, thank you. I'm Robert Siming, signing off. Remember, folks, there is no Tom
Sleep Till Justice.
Woo-hoo. Keith Greg Schaefer.
And we go crash.
This beautiful lyricist, Greg Schaefer.
In a jury trial. In a jury trial. Oh, hike up the verdict a little more. Expose the insured to me. Oh, I got the verdict a little more. Expose the insured to me. In a jury trial. In a jury trial. Crash into you.